welcome back to another episode of the Soundbites podcast by Battery. My name is Bill Binch. I'm an operating partner here at Battery. And today we have a great guest, a true student and expert in the craft of leadership. We have Dennis Lyandris, former CRO of Procore, who oversaw their growth from $10 million in ARR to nearly $1 billion. Just an outstanding leader. And that's going to be the focus of today's topic. I'm a big fan of frameworks. When I think about leadership, I think about frameworks, and he's going to cover a couple of good ones, including results, effort, and learn. Another one called knowledge, process, and skill. Another framework called obsolete yourself. And another framework called outcome oriented. So I look forward to jumping into the content and you joining along for the ride with Dennis Lyandris. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the next episode of Soundbites by Battery. I'm your host, Bill Binch. I'm an operating partner here at Battery. And I'm super excited today for our guest because he is a passionate, and I mean passionate to the nth degree, sales leader. I think you're going to see this come through in the conversation. So I want to welcome our latest guest, Dennis Lyandris, former CRO of Procore. Dennis, welcome to Soundbites.
Thanks, Bill. Honored to get to be here.
Thanks for doing this. I know you and I have had a long relationship, so I'm excited to dive in because there's just so much content to cover with you. So to set the stage before we do dive in, let me give a little background on Dennis. Dennis spent 9 years in the foxhole at Procore as their chief revenue officer, helping them scale from 10 million bucks to nearly $1 billion, going through the private stage, going through the public stage, and really having a large impact on the direction of that organization. And it would be easy for two former sales guys like Dennis and I to sit here and riff about growth. And we're going to do that, but we're going to do it a slightly different way. Normally you'd think two guys like us would sit there and talk about revenue and bookings growth and stuff like that. But today's focus is going to be on a slightly different, higher level than just that type of growth. We're going to spend most of this session talking about really learning and leadership and that type of growth as a professional, as an executive, and how you help your company scale. So Dennis, with that, are you ready to go?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still learning how to be a professional, so hopefully this will help me on that journey. And thanks again for having me, Bill.
Yeah, you bet. Well, like I said earlier, you helped your organization scale from $10 million to $900 million or so. Obviously, several different levels of leadership in that type of business, meaning org structure leadership, definitely different levels and tiers of what your role was and the definition was. And most importantly, you as a professional were having to evolve and having to grow. So I think learning is a great place to start for today. And I'll kick us off with this. I fundamentally think that companies tend to grow faster than the people within. The companies out-accelerate the people. Yet at the same time, human beings, we want to grow ourselves. We want to grow ourselves professionally. We want to grow our role. We want to grow the size of our organization, the amount of people we manage, the money that we make, all these types of things. So it's not as hard to reconcile. So I think that's a great place to dive into and get some of your thoughts around some of the constants that you saw over this 9-year tenure inside of Procore and some of the learnings you picked up along the way.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you, right? When you're in a high growth company and these companies are growing really, really fast, I mean, it's hard to keep your existing remit, right? Because the company is growing so fast. And the company is also changing a lot, right? I am one of those. I think the only constant is change. And I think one thing folks would probably say is very consistent about me is I tend to work very methodically backwards from outcomes. And truthfully, I had this outcome of like, hey, the company's growing really, really fast. So what is it that I might be able to do in order to keep my remit, right? And I was fortunate that in different areas of my upbringing and different areas of my academic career and professionally, I'd come to realize that like learning was actually learnable, right? And so as I was thinking through this outcome of like, how do I keep my remit? And like, what are the examples of folks that have done this and the commonality? I realized like all of them are really good at learning, right? And so I went down this journey of like almost obsessing over like, how do I get really, really good at learning? And how do I make sure that I'm learning the most important things, not just for this phase of scale, but for the next phase of scale? You know, and I think it's one of those things like when I chat with CEOs, I'm now doing like advisory work, and you know, they're like, you mean to tell me like you can codify learning, you can measure and manage and you know, hold folks accountable to learning? And I'm like, you absolutely can, right? I mean, I tried to, you know, lead from the front and set a good example of like, there's a lot of stuff I don't know. So, hey, team, help me figure this stuff out. Like, this is the stuff I'm trying to learn. And I think at Procore, you know, we ended up building this really into everything we do, right? From the most like day-to-day stuff of like, hey, that was a good customer call. Let's do a quick debrief. What did we learn? How is that, you know, building on our learning journey to the really big things, right? How do we hire, fire, and promote when we're recognizing folks at Sales Club? How do we make sure we recognize and celebrate learning that was purposeful and helped people be successful? You know, company all hands. And we ended up building this framework, result, effort, learning. Right. And that was in our performance management process. And it basically, the thought was like, hey, it's our job to make you be successful, right? You've got to get to that result. And you should be able to get there if you're putting in the effort. Another way you can think of effort is execution, right? Are you working hard? Are you working
Right.
smart? And because we're a growth company and we know things are going to keep changing and we want you to grow with us, because that's a great thing to be able to tell your employees. You got to tell them how hard it is, right? But let's play to human nature, as you said, like people want their roles to grow. Then, hey, we want you to get really, really great at learning. And so we had that in all of our QBRs, all of our performance reviews, et cetera. And so I guess I say all that with some passion to be like, I think like learning's a thing. And the more you make it a thing and carry it to your company, the more you can grow the business, the more you can grow your people.
So let me double click into that because you know I love me some frameworks. So results, effort, and learning. So I can see why some of these CEOs that you coach ask about, like, tell me more about the learning, because results are output. They're typically very easily quantified.
Sure.
Effort, clearly you can look back and see what the inputs were to those outputs. But the learning, that's a more difficult thing. And so you mentioned you'd measured it in your QBRs and your performance reviews and things like that. Can you take us a level deeper into how you did that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think sometimes it can be hard to figure out the middle of the pack, right? Like, are they really learning? But the extremities you can usually figure out, right? So you, most companies will say, hey, we want to get every employee on company message, right? And that can be a company-wide learning objective, right? And then that goes into the performance review. And you could just do a simple stand and deliver, right? And you can understand, hey, can someone do that? If you want to make it more scaled out, hey, every employee needs to record on Zoom or whatever technology you're using, their stand and deliver, and we'll have 15 people judge it. You can gamify and make it awesome, celebrate, you know, who does the best at it. As you go through like different levels, you know, it's frankly, I think a little bit easier to look at like a sales rep and be like, hey, here are the 10 things you really
Absolutely.
need to know. I think Michelle, you know, from HubSpot on your podcast did like a wonderful job of like outlining those things, right? And those become things that you can hold folks to. I think where we started to trip up a little bit was like trying to chunk it out even more on the learning. And so we ended up using, not all the time, but a lot of time, this knowledge process skill framework. And that was helping pinpoint even more so where was the learning gap? Was it like you don't even have the knowledge, right? So like one thing that I think we're going to talk about later in this podcast is like leadership is really important, right? Like, do you
Right.
even have that knowledge, that soundbite, right? That like leadership is like maybe, in my opinion, the most important thing. Like, okay, cool. If you do, then we're not working on knowledge. We're trying to understand, like, do you have processes in place to help you learn? Because you got to own it. You got to figure out how to do it. Like, there's a process that you can put in place to
Right.
learning. Do you have it for leadership? And then so much of the stuff is skill, you know, and it's just taking the shots over and over again. And so we would chunk it out sometimes even more specifically. So let me pause there. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it really makes me think of a shared acquaintance that we have. You and I both are familiar with Brett Queener. He's another Santa Barbara guy,
Sure.
live in a similar area like you. He was on one of the board of directors of a company I was at, and he had a really interesting framework, not as I think developed as yours there, but one thing that he was really focused on was this concept called celebrate your suck.
Yeah.
Celebrate what you're not great at. And what it was basically one of those things that as an outsider looking inside the business, it's very easy for you to come in and talk about the things that were not, or sorry, things that we're succeeding in doing well. Like that's easy, right? Checkbox. Then to be able to identify like, hey, this is some of the areas we are working on and putting effort into. But one thing that a lot of people don't do is call out where they themselves are not succeeding. And whether that's, like you said, the knowledge, the process, or the skill, or maybe I don't have the right team underneath me. There's a number of different things there. The idea there was if you're self-aware enough to call it out, it means that you're probably already in a learning mindset because you're not fearful of identifying that there's something I don't know.
Totally agree. And I think that, you know, the more you embrace learning and realize, like, as a student of learning, and, you know, I'm a student, I'm by no means a teacher. But one thing I've come to appreciate is, like, you learn more from your failures, right? But how you think about it really, really matters. And so for us, as we were codifying learning, for example, like, we had a mantra that was like, win or learn. And when you're learning, what we're really looking at is like, how fast are you learning? Right. And again, that's why we had these quarterly check-ins in this instrumentation. And there's a mindset game to be played, right? Like, are you curious? Are you humble? Do you have ownership? You know, I love the work that's been published by Carol Dweck on growth mindset, right? More broadly. And I think that all fits into this, like, hey, like you have to know where you're not hitting and you've got to be able to figure out how to bridge those gaps. And that's all a learning game. You know, and there's lots of ways to do it, right? Like I tend to be the person who's pretty good at messing it up myself. And, you know, being like, oh, darn. And so I think you can learn from making your own mistakes. I think the other way that I've learned a lot, right, and kind of embraced my suck and then figured out what to do about it is through the wisdom of others, right? Through podcasts like yours, through mentors, those sorts of things. But long-winded, yeah, you got me on the passion thing. This is a subject I like. long-winded way to say, like, yeah, I think absolutely, like, you've got to have a culture where you're like, hey, if we're not winning, we're learning, and we want to be exceptional at learning.
That's so great. I had a ride, not quite as large as yours was, Dennis, of being with Marketo from roughly about zero to a couple hundred million bucks. And what was interesting is during that time from zero, when we had one product in the US that sold to one subsegment of the US, small business, to, you know, 8 years later, when it's a global company, the product's translated into seven languages, offices all over, you know, we sell small, medium, large. People from the outside of Marketo, all they saw was a linear line up and to the right. And what I remember was all the brick walls that we ran full speed into. So when you talk about messing it up, I'm 100% a student of that same way of learning, is when people talk about, you know, like, hey, share your successes. I can point to some key metrics that we achieved during that time frame. But where I really come alive is when someone asks about what'd you learn from that process? Because I learned that there's no one playbook. I learned that the playbook that you use there doesn't apply necessarily at the next place. But what I learned is that we as an organization had to go through that process together.
Absolutely. And I think this is why, you know, Procore, I think has done just such an amazing job of building a learning organization and a learning culture. And I think, like, look, the only constant is change. Like, you can't prepare for COVID or generative AI or all these things that are going to keep coming at you, you know, competitive changes, strategy changes, product issues, like whatever it is. And so I think that learning is where there's the most amount of opportunity to build a winning culture and a winning organization.
I think you're seeing that show itself too in a lot of companies. Their value statements that they're coming in is a lot of times you'll see values that are about, like, use the word curious. And I think that's a really important word, is a learning mentality. Do you have that interest in coming in and being a part of something great? Well, if you're joining a high growth company, chances are that roles are going to change, definitions are going to shift, you're going to take on different roles inside of the organization. And you've got to have some curiosity to do that, not just plant the flag once and say, I'm going to stay here.
Yeah. And look, I mean, to frameworks, I think that, you know, what I came to really appreciate was these things that might seem like there's not a framework for, like, hey, is there a framework for learning? Is there a framework for doing good change management? I think you and I have both seen change management probably done well, but we've also seen it done cringeworthy, you know? And these things all things you can learn. So yeah, I guess that's my, like, thing on, like, learning to learn and making that a thing is really valuable. And it was tremendously impactful to me.
That's great. Well, let's circle back to another item you said there, which was mentorship. You mentioned podcasts. I know you've had the fortune to be exposed to professional coaches, formal mentors, and things like that. I'd love to hear about people's impact on your development and how you really view that now.
With so much gratitude. I think that I was just honestly so blessed and so privileged to have some of the greatest of the greats be willing to help me with mentorship. I do think there's a dirty little secret in mentorship that the mentor gets as much out of it as the mentee. Now that I'm doing some mentorship myself, I'm like, yeah, this is pretty awesome. But for me, I was always intentional in my mentorship, and I think I've kind of changed my mind a little bit over the years on mentorship. There was a period of time where I really felt like, hey, your mentor has to be someone who's like kind of done what you've done, right? So they've, led a go-to-market organization, high growth, taken it public, all that sort of stuff. And then I realized, like, man, relationships are like the thing that give you so much joy and meaning and purpose, not just at work, but in life. And if I have a mentor who I've just got a great relationship with, they're an epic critical thinker, maybe they haven't seen, this show, but they understand how things rhyme and they help me think through problems. So they're more kind of, agnostic or not domain specific mentors. That actually can be really awesome. And, I think my latest thinking is like both are great. Take what you can get, and for me, I use mentors really strategically, right? So I did think a lot about like, how do I make a good experience for them? I do think like, if you're going to ask Bill Binch to mentor you, hopefully you've gone through every bit of content Bill has put out there. Like, hopefully you have a value proposition that makes it fun and awesome and meaningful for Bill. And I tried to do that. And then for me, a lot of it was leveraging a sort of breadth of mentors. So I was one of those folks who built kind of an advisory board. We gave those folks some stock. And I often would check in with, three people on the same problem. And what
Right.
I was looking for, and this is kind of me and my own way of learning, is like, where can I get them all to agree? And sometimes I would like have this thing that I'm like, I think this is the way to do it, but I'm not sure. And I literally sent three text messages and, I get a response and all of them were like, seriously, yeah, you're on the right track. And I'd be like, cool, I don't even need to have a conversation with them. Other times there are things that you're like, okay, like this is hard and I got to chart my own like path. But yeah, I find mentors to be one of the most powerful ways to learn. And I think that it's a blessing and a gift to be able to have one.
Okay, so I think a key soundbite here for any person in leadership, doesn't matter if you're CEO or a functional leader or what, but I'll reinforce what you said. I think you said you were blessed by getting a lot of great people. I think really collecting a group of people, because like you said, it's not a bunch of yes folks, it's a bunch of folks that can be critical thinkers and help you. And so whether that's an advisor, and this is great advice to founders, I've also been the fortunate recipient of that where my CEO is willing to give shares and give somebody a financial, a financial like win from spending time with me. I've had the ability to have professional coaches who knew nothing about my domain, but what they knew about was leadership
Totally.
type of mindsets. I've been fortunate to be able to tap into advisors inside of some of the investment companies that were invested inside of the organization I was working within. And so I think it's a great leadership hack right there that if you have exposure to them, take advantage of it.
Totally. And I look to build on it and maybe connect some of the dots. When I talk to CEOs and like, I don't understand, like, how do I help my CMO learn better? Hey, you could have a learning objective, going back to that result effort learning, framework of like, I'm going to help the CMO find two mentors who are exceptionally awesome. And by the way, one of them could be a CMO who's become a CEO, because then that'll really help develop that CMO to support the CEO better. But I think these are the ways that you can make learning very specific and measurable and understand how do people learn. And mentors are just one of the best ways to learn. So yeah, plus a thousand to what you're saying.
It's such a important part of the growth of somebody. Anybody that I've talked to that's scaled through several stages of an organization, I think a universal trait of all of them is they talk about the people that help them. And I have a mentor that I still have to this day, lives nearby me, and he's taught me so many things. And the interesting thing is, while I've spent the last 15 or years of my career focused on small business and building startups up, he's the complete polar opposite. He goes into big 1,000+ sales organizations, not companies, that sales organizations, and leads those. And so you'd look at that from the outside and be like, well, how does he help you? And the fact is he just has such a different point of view that's what helps me. Is he's just not looking at it from the same, he's not cut out of central casting is what I'm saying. And he has this concept that our careers are built around, and a lot of people have probably been apt to hear me say this, this three-stage thing: learn, earn, and return. You know, your first stage of your career is learning your skill and you're learning your craft. Then you move on to earning your reputation as whatever you do, hopefully earning some money. And then you never stop the first or the second one. You keep picking those up as you go through your career. And then you finally get to a stage where you start giving back. And that's the return stage, where you become one of these people that's sought after for some experience that you have.
I love that. That's awesome.
Well, good stuff. That's a great, I think, transition over to from learning and over into leadership here, Dennis. So when you look back, you know, you had this career, you started up, you worked for a few software companies like Pentaho and then Cloudera, learned some skills, developed a little bit of your reputation in earning that, made this move into Procore at a fairly early stage. When you look at Procore and going through that incredible growth over nearly a decade, I'm sure you look back and you see challenges and you see people as key elements in the mix, that wow, a lot of my role was to go solve problems, and a lot of the role or a lot of the outcome of solving those problems was dictated by the people that were surrounding me. Let's dive into leadership here, because I think this is a great place to talk about people and take us a step past learning.
Yeah. You know, I mean, for me, look, I think people are sort of the beginning and end of every problem. And I do think the hardest problems in an organization are people problems, right? And I think that makes sense, right? And so for me, when I kind of do this outcome-oriented thing that I do all the time, and I'm like, okay, like, hey, I really want to win, and so I got to figure out how to learn the things that are most important to winning. You know, it hit me pretty early at Procore. I don't think it hit me before that I was like, huh, the most important thing to winning, and I've come to have really strong beliefs in this these days, is the most important thing to winning is leadership. And leadership is also the hardest thing you can do. And it makes sense, right? Because it's how you're taking care of your people. And I've come to find that, you know, most of my time, probably starting 18 months into the Procore journey, so maybe 30, 40 million in revenue, was all oriented around learning leadership. And this is another one of those things that I have a lot of passion behind, you know, is like, look, I think leadership is something you can learn and get better at, right? And it is also codifiable, right? It has a set of fundamentals. And that's why these professional coaches, which I, you know, forgot to mention, I did also use, right, are really powerful, right? Because they can say, hey, look, like, the fundamentals of a great leader are they know how to communicate well, right? They know how to set a vision and a strategy, right? They can prioritize and simplify and delegate. And so for me, like, I've come to believe that, like, the most rewarding thing you can do in business is also the hardest thing. It's also the most important thing to winning. And that's leadership. And so, like, I'll start there. And, you know, I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Well, I'll do a soundbite alert here, because you have this statement that you mentioned to me a while ago, and I thought it was so great. And it's obsolete yourself. When you're thinking about leadership, your role is really to get yourself out of your own way. Can you break that one down for us?
Yeah, I mean, it's that same kind of outcome-oriented thinking, which kind of brings together, and I hadn't thought about it until right now, you know, what we're talking about, which is like, as I'm like learning, hey, how do I keep my remit, right? And I'm like, okay, the most important thing is leadership, right? And that's people and growing and developing them. And then I'm like, okay, so what's like the most important thing a leader can do?
Right.
And I believe it's work yourself out of a job, you know, and I think it changes the way you approach every situation, because now every situation becomes someone else's work, their learning and growth opportunity. And I think if you're just practical about it, you're like, hey, like, what I'm going to need to do in order to drive growth of this business is going to keep changing. And so if I can't give away the work I'm doing today, how am I going to take on more? Right. And so for me, you know, I think that, like, there's no greater joy But there's also no more practical thing you can do in business than be like, hey, boss, how else can I help you? And what other hard problems can I solve? Because I got two people, not just one, who are crushing it and could do the job I'm doing today. And I think that's the way that you keep elevating up and out to solve harder problems.
Yeah, I think I was probably 4, maybe 5 years into management, just earlier in my career, when someone said this statement. It's just so captain obvious, but it hit me like a brick that day. They said, "You know why you're not getting promoted, right?" And I was like, "No, I'm being held back." And it was like, "Because you're too good at your job." And I was like, "What do you mean? Like, how could that hold me back?" And they said, "You're so good at your job that you're irreplaceable. You have not found somebody that works in your organization that the company feels comfortable in promoting you, and that they're going to fill your shoes." And it, like I said, it hit me like a brick, which was like, I've had this all wrong all these years. I always thought it was about being exceptional at what I do and controlling the narrative. And in fact, it was about giving the narrative away. Let someone else take the credit for this.
I mean, and it's hard, right? Because like you also end up, truthfully, it's not like it's, this clean, easy, process. Like it's messy, right? You end up explaining to your boss, you're like, hey, there's this really important meeting and like, how come you weren't there and it didn't go as well and this thing happened? You're like, ha, someone else's development opportunity, but I probably should have set them up better. And it's just much harder, right? I mean, you have to have a level of mastery to be able to teach something that is far different than the ability you need to be able to do it. And yeah, I think that shifting in thinking for me was really profound, which is like, I had a mentor who told me once, and he was like, look, Dennis, I know you work like a maniac, but you need to start to ask yourself, if you're working more than 40 or 50 hours a week, and you absolutely have to, and it's every week, you're doing someone else's job. Who are you going to hire or fire? And, I made that my own over time by saying, you know what? No matter whether I have to hire or fire, I might have talent internally. I got to train, and I got to train and develop. But the thought is still salient with me to this day, right? Which is like, why do I have to do this? And shouldn't this be someone else's work and someone else's opportunity? And then I'm able to take an even more strategic role and do even, more important things to help the team. So yeah, I totally agree with that shift in mindset. It's hard though.
It is hard. I mean, like what you're saying there is you're losing sleep at night. Are people that are working for you sleeping well, or are they losing sleep at night? And if they're sleeping well, there's something wrong with the imbalance here. You're carrying too much load. And it's interesting, if you look at, like, there is a famous Harvard Business Review case study. God, it must be 40 something years old now. It's called Who's Got the Monkey? And it's a famous one
I love this one.
that
Yeah, go.
Every meeting, you go into a meeting with another person or other individuals, and there's monkeys that jump around the room. And like the whole message there is, who leaves owning the monkey? And if you're the leader and you walk out of that meeting every time with all the monkeys, then, well, what are all those people that are in your organization there for? They're there to like learn the problem, or to solve the problem that you've probably solved previously, and thus that's what helped get you promoted into your higher role.
Totally, right? And if you want those people to be able to take your role so you can keep doing different things. And I know like you and I share some stories around this where we've been stuck with like a problem, right? Where we're like, oh shoot, like so these two leaders, neither of them are gonna like this. This is gonna be really tough. Like, how do I fix this? And you're like, you know what? Like if they're team first people and they're the people I know they are and I've hired well and I believe in them, then I'm gonna get them in a room and I'm gonna be like, hey, folks. We got this problem and it's my problem, but now the monkey's on your back and it's your problem. And it then becomes their growth and the development opportunity. You then get to assess talent. Like, I think you've seen this many times over too, but it's one of the most powerful things I've learned to do is like give the monkey to someone else.
It's so true, because think about the times when you probably didn't do that, and you hear these kind of comments from your team, which is like, I'd like to be in the room for that decision. I'd like to be that. Well, now all of a sudden you put them in that room, and it's like, hey, team, I have this problem, but it's really your problem now. I want you two to solve it. And they're like, well, why are you dishing the work to me? It's like, because if I go come up with the answer, you're going to be like, well, you came up with the solution. We weren't involved in it. Now here it is. This is yours. Like, you guys have veto authority. Like, go solve this problem. So I see that. That's some 401 level advanced thinking there. Like that's like more like not even like 400, maybe graduate study thinking on leadership there.
Yeah, but it's part of the playbook, so to speak, in the code of operations, right? I think you talk to, wise leaders that like have truly won hearts and minds. They've done great things for their people and they've achieved great business outcomes through it. And they're like, oh yeah, for sure. I mean, one of my more humbling lessons was, there are things where I'm like, I think my plan might be a better plan. I'm not sure, by the way. But like I came to learn that like someone else's plan, like 80% as good as what I think might be the 90% good plan. They thought about it, they're gonna own it, they're committed to it, right? And they're gonna run through walls to make that successful. And so yeah, I mean, it's a funny story. I had a leader who was exceptional, right? Like he was truly a gifted leader. He was crushing his numbers, and I knew he kept wanting to get promoted, right? And I didn't see him giving away the monkeys, right? And so I took him and a couple of his peers out for a hike, and we're going on a hike, and we pack some snacks, right? And you can't make this up, right? He puts a backpack on his back. And the rest of the team's like, hey, man, isn't your shoulder a little banged up? Like, can we carry the backpack? Right? And he's like, no, I got the backpack. You guys don't have to do that. Don't worry about it. I got the backpack, right? And we're cruising. And like, you could see like that little bit of discomfort, right? And like, like the team really cared about this guy. And you're like, and finally he gives up the backpack, right? And someone else is carrying it, and they're like feeling good. They got a great like, workout. And I had used this like, hey, monkey not on your back, like give away the work. And I just looked at him and I was like, you know what the lesson is here, right? Don't carry the backpack. Give someone else the backpack, And he just, it's funny because once you get it, you like really get it. And you're like, oh, cool, good to go. So yeah, I totally agree with you.
Yeah, it's this is a fascinating topic. I could riff forever. I mean, it's interesting the paradox between you read these books like Leaders Eat Last, and then you read these other books like Multipliers, which are about like giving things away. And so there's so much out there, but you're right. Like it goes back to the first part of this podcast, which was about the learning mentality is we all talk about situational leadership. We got to assess the situation, but we always have to continually do it, continue to do that so that we grow. But I'm so glad you brought the story in there. It's always good to talk about that. Let's shift to a couple of other things here. I know we wanted to talk about learning and leadership for the most of this, but I think there's a couple of other things from your past, Dennis, that are really worth exploring to share with the listeners of the podcast here. One of them is around go-to-market excellence, which is really I think, the intersection of learning and leadership together. So you obviously have a point of view on this. As a leader, you're not an expert in every function. You're not the best at everything. You have to have assembled the team. Love to get some riffs from you on that topic.
I think best teacher is necessity, right? And so, for me, I started out as Procore's EVP of sales, and I did that for about 4 years. And then I moved into a role overseeing all the go-to-market teams, right? So that was sales, marketing, customer success,
Sure.
business development, rev operations. And it was hard, right? Like, truthfully, it was extremely hard. And, one thing that, as I always think about learning, like, I try to ask myself, like, is this really that unique of a challenge? Because if it's not, there's probably wisdom I can borrow and learn from, folks who have done this, right? And the truth is that, like, every CEO faces this challenge, right? They can't be a subject matter expert in all the departments that they've overseen. How could you know more about legal than your head of legal, more
Right.
about technology than your head of technology, right? And so it forces you to think really, really thoughtfully around like, what is my unique value proposition to this team? And so when we brought the go-to-market teams together, and I can talk about why, but we felt like it was a really powerful way to differentiate the customer experience, to partner with product, to get them really good feedback on kind of voice of market. So there are like a whole host of reasons why we were like, hey, let's bring these teams together. And, for me, it was a work of like, hey, look, one team, one dream. You could say it the other way a little less, positively, which is like team fails, we all fail. And so, as I was working through with this team, it was like, hey, if we only do one thing, we have to hit the number. Like, I have very strong thoughts that like you are as good as your number. There's only one scoreboard. I actually don't think this is specific to just go to market. I think this is a company thing, right? If your
Right.
strategy, your product, you're thinking thoughtfully, both in quarter, out quarter, multi-year, like you should be able to consistently hit your numbers. But, beyond that, right, each of these departments is different, Right. And they bring to bear their own superpowers. They have their own challenges. They have their own friction points. Right. And so I spent a lot of my time using learning and leadership to like try to figure those things out. And, you know, we got to a spot where, you know, every department had a metric that they owned. And we believed in the value of each department in a really sincere way, where we're like, hey, we want you to matter a lot. And I believe that the harder the problem you solve and the more important of a metric you own in the business, the more you matter to the business and to the company, right? And you want to matter, right? Like that's I think a given. And so we ended up, you know, having a marketing owned pipeline, which I think is the most important leading metric in the company. We had customer success own net retention and gross margin. Gross margin because customer support rolled up under my organization. And that metric's really important, right? Our business development team owned attach rate. We had evolved the business from kind of product to platform, and honestly, bringing a solution to our customers required partners. So they were metriced on attach rate for how they helped us find deals, how they helped us close deals, and how we renewed and expanded and made customers referenceable. You know, and then RevOps, I kind of flipped. They too are such a powerful leverage organization that they spent a lot of time making sure rep productivity worked. I have some pretty strong thoughts on like make sure your reps are getting productive, and also forecasting, because I think the output of running a really great operation is predictability, even if it's not hitting the number. And so that's kind of what we did in terms of bringing the go-to-market teams together and in terms of giving them all a metric that really mattered, but all of it laddering up ultimately to revenue and all of them getting paid ultimately on that one metric.
That's a for everybody listening, that's a playbook right there of some best in class operations inside of a revenue organization. And I love the overarching revenue focus. Now, Dennis, one thing you said there that I'm sure a few listeners are like writing some notes down, like lifted up their head when you said it, was that the CS team was measured on net retention and gross margin. Wouldn't a lot of people say they should be measured on CSAT? Like, what are your thoughts around that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's no like one size fits all. I think there's pros cons, right? I think the con of CSAT, like there's a lot of pros, right? Like they're single-mindedly focused on keeping the customer happy. A happy customer, you know, is an advocate. That's really good for the brand. Like there's a lot of reasons that CSAT is rad. But ultimately, I don't think that's going to be the metric that you're going to go back to, you know, Wall Street, to your board of directors, to your employees, to the product organization, and say, hey, like, we want a seat at the table because we solved this really important thing. And I just believe in the power of CS to actually deliver on that outcome. Like any of these metrics, by the way, you can't do it alone. So that's one of those teamwork tricks, right? Which is like, hey, we're all interdependent on each other. So let's figure out how the heck to get along, right? And how to work together. But yeah, I mean, I think CS, you know, having CSAT is a valid metric, but I personally, believe in their ability, and I think they matter a heck of a lot more when they own net retention versus CSAT.
I actually agree with it. I'm calling it out because I think it's a bit controversial, and we love some good controversies on the show. I analogize CSAT to pipeline, NRR to like closed won, right? It's the input and the output, right? Like it's certainly important. I don't think either of us are saying it's not important. I think what we're saying though is when you met, like, happy customers renew and happy customers expand. And like you said, you had a BD team that was there driving attach rate because you had gone from multi-product or from single product to multi-products and growing into a platform. And when you're a platform, all of a sudden expansion becomes really important. And who does expansion? Who helps drive that is your CS team on making sure that the customer's healthy, using your product and is getting value out of it.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think to build on what you're saying, like, I think you invest more based on the problem that someone's solving. So if you're a CS leader and you're willing to take on that challenge, right, and you sit down, you know, and you're like, hey, give me $1 million because it's going to grow NRR by this amount, I think that's a more compelling story than, hey, give me $1 million and CSAT is going to go up. And I promise you, eventually, CSAT is going to lead to NRR. And it does. But again, I think the more as a leader you're like, hey, here's what you can hold me accountable to, and it's something that really, really matters, the better off you are. You know, it's the same way, like, you know, are you going to look to an SDR organization for like the effort of like, hey, you know, you set up a meeting, right? Which is great. Or do you actually want to see that pipeline and do you want to see that pipeline convert, right? Which metric
Correct.
matters more?
Correct. So true. couple of other items I want to get your thoughts on. You mentioned earlier you're doing advising to CEOs, you've been doing some mentorship and things like that. So a common question I'm sure you get is around career advice. We've obviously just talked about learning and leadership, so I can imagine where some of those things are. But what are some of the top elements that you think about when you're thinking about giving back to others and the career advice that you can share?
You know, so I think it's unfair to say this, but I'm going to say it because I really believe it. I think if there's only one thing you do to make your career really successful, I think you got to pick a great company. And I think you kind of want to Goldilocks what that company looks like, right? And so to me, I think that, you know, having a great career first really matters, right? I mean, you're going to get so much of your meaning and purpose in life and the amount of time you spend, your financial success, like the career matters, right? So then if we're like, this really matters, how do I nail it? I think that these growth companies, you know, they're 50 million in ARR, they're growing exceptionally fast, right? They're backed by a really stellar tier one investor, you know, like a Battery. I think those are the places you want to go make your career, right? I think they're early enough, right, that they don't have process. They're still pretty flexible on how they move talent around the org. You're going to see departments built. You're going to see departments kind of close down. You're going to see new markets. You're going to see markets fail. You're going to see them succeed. You know, within that, I do like founder-led companies. You know, I think there's just something really magical and special about a founder with a vision and what they're able to do. I like companies that are investing a lot in R&D. You know, I think that really shows, I mean, we're selling software at the end of the day, right? And so like, right, let's make sure that we're going to keep having the goods. You know, I loved how Kerry Liu on your show kind of framed it, you know, beyond picking a great company of like, hey, you know, I think the leadership team obviously matters, right? It's going to be a great company because it has a great leadership team. And I think if you just go into that company trying to learn as much as possible, like Kerry Liu said it better than I'm able to say it around, like, hey, just raise your hand. You know, if there's M&A happening and you're like, hey, I'm not asking for a title or a comp change or anything, but like, I think I could help you integrate this acquisition and I'd love to just work with you and learn. And that goes back to, you know, what we were talking about in go-to-market excellence, like solve the hardest problems you can. You know, That's so right. When I think about a career, I feel like it really, really matters. And there's an unfair amount of attribution that happens to just being at a great company. I think the opposite, unfortunately, is also true. Like if you did epic work at a company that failed, I don't think that's going to play out as well for you. And so I like these, you know, pre-IPO, 50 million in ARR, founder-led, highly technical, epic product, and just a place where you can learn and build really great relationships.
It's so right. My last guest was Jean Grosser from Stripe, and we had a similar dialogue about this, that she joined Stripe in 2016. And like right now in 2024, it's pretty easy to look at and be like, oh, wow, Stripe's just a monster. But in 2016, yeah, this just wasn't that obvious. And when I asked her that exact question, what led you there? Because she was a classic B2B software sales leader at that stage of her career. And what made you decide to go to this thing that's selling to developers at basically an interchange fee? And she walked through the right, company values, you know, and said that, yeah, like that was really incredible or really important to her. And it obviously led to an incredible run inside of that organization. So another good set of learnings from you, Dennis. Thanks for that. Last topic that I want to get to, and it begs the obvious because it's on the lips of everybody in SaaS software right now, but specifically around the go-to-market function, but the impact of generative AI on the revenue function. I know you have a few ideas about how you're thinking about this. Love to have you share your wisdom on the show here.
Yeah. You know, truthfully, I'm learning a lot and I'm seeing some really cool stuff happen in some of the companies that, you know, I'm partnering with and advising. I mean, look, to me at the highest level, one question I ask myself is this like fleeting or is this really a seminal shift? And I think it is a seminal shift, right? So I think not having an approach to how you're going to learn how to use, you know, AI to support your go-to-market teams is almost like saying we're not going to give our people the internet when the internet's available, or it's right, like being on a typewriter when computers are available. You know, then from there, like, I don't think it's replacing humans, right? Which I think is one of the questions that venture folks seem to wonder is like, hey, can I just get rid of a bunch of people now? Like, you might, but I think probably more practically what you can do is get even more productivity out of those people. You know, I think if it replaces humans, we're probably in the Terminator era and like Dude, I'm not qualified to talk about what the heck we're going to do in that environment. But I think, in the current state, like I think finding use cases that really enable your people to be more productive, to do their highest and best work, to increase the quantity and the quality of the work that they do, I think is the place to play. And not to draw too much on Carrie Lou, I did love that episode though with her. I think she talked a lot about like a practical way to start the learning journey, right? Of like, bring in other vendors, ask what others are doing. And so, to me, I think it's early days of figuring out like, hey, your people are going to want to use these tools and it's going to drive engagement and success for them. So figure out how to use them. But don't go on science projects, right? Like really make it valuable, figure out what use cases and workloads you can drive. That make your people more productive.
Yeah, I think the experimentation part is really critical there. There's a lot of companies being formed right now, so it's early days of saying I'm going to bring in a specific tool or a specific platform to do something. But you said productivity. If you asked me to put my pencils down and say, what am I seeing out there? What I'd say is the average sales rep in the SaaS software world probably spends somewhere around 20% of their time in front of their buyers. And I look at it and say, if generative AI can help our salespeople spend more time, if that figure can become 25% or 30%, you think about how much more impactful that will be to our businesses. Because right now, there's just a tremendous amount of work that goes into getting on the phone with a potential buyer before you do. And so I think about productivity as measured by that of the percentage of time that our sellers are in front of their potential buyers.
Yeah. And what I love about that is like, personally, as a leader, I think one of the most awesome things you can do is just spend time with the front lines, the marketers, the sellers, customer success folks, and be like, how can I make your day more awesome and productive? And I think these tools have a lot of power to do that. And you look at marketing and you're like, hey, like you should be focused on figuring out like the most compelling, unique, differentiated messaging. Some of the semantics that then come from there, like generative AI does pretty well. Right. But we still need a human to figure out what is that differentiated message we go to market with. Right. And so
Right.
those are the places I think right now I would be an advocate. Like you should already be figuring out how you're doing that for your people. I totally agree.
This is great. Dennis, I gotta say, you're a special breed. Most of us don't go through a run like you did at Procore. So, what you said, going back to picking a great company, founder-led company, you did that. You were able to get in the door, prove your value to the organization, and continue to learn and grow. And I really appreciate you jumping on the podcast with me today and sharing some of that experience and some of those learnings with the listeners. So thank you for doing that.
It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for doing this podcast, Bill.
Terrific. Thanks, Dennis.